Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
At this point, our program, we go around the room and introduce ourselves. My name is David Lewis. I see everybody, full room this morning.
Douglas Hall.
Eric City.
I'm Leonard.
I'm Jerry.
My name is Freddie.
Jim Flanagan.
My name is Rob.
My name is Cass.
My name is Chris.
I'm Shantanu.
All right.
I'm Carl Wolf.
I'm David.
I'm Mark.
Paul.
Andre.
Daniel.
My name is Gary.
My name is Howard Deport.
My name is Tony.
I'm Bradford.
I'm Michael.
Peter.
Jim Stewart.
I'm George.
I'm Ray Dyer.
Jim.
Peter.
Jeff.
Eric.
Name is Jay.
Jack.
I'm Jerry.
Mark.
Richard Azzolini.
Matt.
David Axel.
My name is Roy.
My name is Michael.
My name is Jerry Jones.
David.
Bill.
Ron.
My name is Jeffrey.
Alan.
Leor.
My name is Glenn.
Rule.
Lee.
I'm Tom Bruin.
My name is Dennis.
I'm Paul.
My name is T.H. Lillia.
Rich.
I'm not.
This anybody? Is anyone here for the first time this morning?
Anybody in the other room?
We all give our
hands. Well, welcome. You're here for the first time. We have a social half hour after the program. Feel free to hang around and share some snacks, have a cup of tea, and meet some of the members of the Sangha. Our speaker this morning is Jack Morin. He's been studying the mysteries of Eros for three decades as a psychotherapist and sex researcher in San Francisco Bay Area. He is the author of The Erotic Mind, Unlocking the Inner Sources of Sexual Passion and Fulfillment, which offers a bold new psychology of desire and arousal based on his clinical experience as well as in-depth analysis of over 7,000 anonymous descriptions of peak real-life encounters and fantasies. He is also the author of the international classic Anal Pleasure and Health, A Guide for Men and Women. He writes and lectures for lay and professional audiences about the paradoxes, challenges, and potentials of sexuality and intimate relationships. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you.
Who wrote that?
I should get a copy of that. Well, thanks for welcoming me back. I really had a wonderful experience when I was here before, and we were discussing erotic integrity. And today we're talking about shame, but there's quite a bit of overlap. Because, as I think we'll get into today, I know we will, shame is really can be a major impediment to the development of erotic integrity. And on the other side, developing erotic integrity is a tremendous kind of anti-shame thing to do. So it's not altogether different, although we're going to be mostly focusing today on the experience of shame, how it comes about, and how it can be healed, how we can deal with it. You know, shame is an extremely important, super complex emotion, but it's also very, very difficult emotion, because as I'm sure you all know, shame, depending on really how much of it we deal with, causes so many people just enormous levels of distress in their lives. And I know that in preparing for today, I got to thinking about instances where I have felt shame. It kind of was a catalyst to bring that up, and you may find that our discussion today has the same effect on you. And that can be a valuable thing to tune into your own experiences of shame, but it could also be a painful thing. And so I wanted to mention this up front and suggest that, you know, if you notice yourself tuning into or remembering experiences of shame for yourself today, that you have an intention going into it of kind of just accepting what you notice without judgment. It's kind of a mindful approach to it, and certainly not deny that it's there, but see if you can just notice it and even maybe have a little detachment from it, that there it is. This is a part of me and my experience. Let's talk about what shame is. I had plenty of ideas about it. I always have to take a look at the old Merriam-Webster and see what they have to say. They've actually got three definitions in there, which are, to me, are not clearly differentiated from each other at all, which is kind of unusual. Definition number one is it's a painful emotion caused by the consciousness of guilt, shortcoming, or impropriety. And then the second part of that definition is, or the susceptibility to such emotions. Number two is a condition of humiliating disgrace or disrepute. That would be probably a more serious version of shame. And then number three is something that brings censure or reproach, but also something to be regretted, which is when we say, gee, it's a shame that you can't go to the party. So this is obviously a very mild form of shame, probably shouldn't be called shame at all, but it is a usage in our language. But it is important to recognize that shame exists on a spectrum, that's part of what we look at when we look at shame. How strong, how deep, how long-lasting, what is the impact of it? Some shame, hopefully, it's a passing, experience, whereas other experiences of shame will stay with us, often for a lifetime. Experientially, it seems to me, and you may have your own ideas about this, of course, but the essential experience of shame in its significant forms is basically unwanted exposure. It's like having something distasteful about ourselves seen and discovered by others. And so the physical experience is usually the lowering of the head, the covering of the face, the turning away from eye contact. That's part of that urge to hide and kind of not be seen, to retreat into the shadows to avoid further exposure. And then I've noticed and talked with many others about it, there's a overall physical and I think psychic constriction. Everything shrinks and we become small and helpless in the moment of shame. But shame is being so complex the way it is, it's intertwined with a whole bunch of other emotions. Once we've had shame, particularly of a serious variety, it's so uncomfortable that we'll do almost anything to avoid having it again. It's kind of like if anyone here, I'm sure people have had a panic attack, you know that you will generally try to think of anything that you can to avoid having that happen again because it's so unpleasant. Shame is not panic, but it's like panic in that way. We'll naturally try to avoid it. And so people who have especially multiple experiences of shame go through life with a lot of fear and anxiety that it might happen again. And with that comes a general inhibition, a caution, a temptation to withdraw, to not be too out there, to not be seen. Now, this, by the way, this withdrawal to avoid shame is different than shyness. Shyness is like, well, it's a complicated thing too, but it seems to be, at least in part, a personality characteristic. And people who are shy, there are signs of that in infants, even around one year old. Careful observers can tell which people are going to end up being shy. So it's, to some extent, shyness is something we may be born with, but then, of course, shame can make it much, much worse. Now, guilt is also a part of the whole shame experience, but a lot of people, including myself, have tried to differentiate shame from guilt. What's the difference? I think in reality we use the terms interchangeably a lot, and that's perfectly okay because there is tremendous overlap. But generally speaking, I would say that guilt experiences have more to do with specific things that we did that we feel bad about and realize we could have done it differently and we wish we had. And so guilt has this specific quality to it, whereas shame, especially when it gets bad, it takes on a global form. It's not like I did something wrong, but I am wrong to the core. So that's probably the closest thing we have to a difference between shame and guilt. But I would say don't worry about it. Then, of course, along with shame comes a feeling of helplessness. And for many people, a depression, which is really the shutting down, the withdrawal, the retreat, the turning off of the life force within us. Now, this is a whole other thing. People often don't recognize, or it's, some do, is that very often there's anger and tremendous resentment toward the shaming forces that have made us feel that way. Many people feel conflicted about that because they feel bad about themselves and enraged at the same time toward whoever has made them feel the shame. Then also, when people have a lot of shame going on, there is a tendency, not universal by any means, to become hypercritical of others and to put them down. Whenever possible, it's like to bring them down to your level, or hopefully lower, so that there's someone worse off than you, you know. And then here's a paradoxical thing about shame that we're going to be exploring today in different ways, and that is all of these things I've described so far is the kind of constriction, the turning away, the shutting down. Shame also, in some instances, produces a fascination, even an obsession, with the forbidden impulses that we had and the rules that we violated. So that shame really can energize the very thing that it is designed to suppress. And we'll see how this operates as we move along today. And we see a lot of this in our erotic lives, which I'll talk about shortly. Now, why the heck do we have this emotion of shame, which seems so destructive and clearly has that potential? Well, actually, it seems like shame is a social emotion. It grows out of the fact that we don't live as separate beings, most of us, that we are social creatures. We form and crave connections. We need them, actually, for our well-being and our very survival. And so we form attachments. And bonds, and out of that, families and communities and cultures. And that shame is actually, to some degree, a necessary and really very effective means of social control. It's used by groups that we belong to keep the behavior of the members of that group within certain bounds. And so when people venture outside of those bounds, the shame reaction, it, on the one hand, it's sort of the person feels excluded, but they end up coming back to the group, hopefully, and acting better in the future. So it really produces a kind of a certain minimal level of conformity within the group situation. So I would say, I guess, that normal people, like us, we have shame because we're human. It's part of the human experience in us and our connectedness with others. And the other thing about shame is that it requires a self-awareness. People who are totally unaware of themselves, do not examine themselves, don't have shame. And at the most extreme form, we're talking here about the sociopaths. These are the people who are totally shame-free or shameless. They don't examine themselves, seem to have a very limited capacity to do so, or interest. They also don't have the ability to empathize with other people. And shame does involve a certain empathy. So there's a kind of a self-awareness. It's a kind of an advanced emotion, in a way. In fact, some people in psychology refer to shame as one of the self-conscious emotions, not in the sense of being self-conscious, although it fits in the case of shame, but where it requires a certain awareness of the self to have it. And that would be in the same category as also guilt and pride even hubris, which is kind of the opposite of shame in some ways. It's thinking we're fabulous, you know, or really having an inflated sense of ourselves. They all require a kind of ability to self-reflect and self-evaluate. As you know, I'll just go over this quickly, that there's related tools for social control to shame. One of them is shunning. It's extremely powerful, pushing someone out of the family, out of the group. I'm not going to go particularly into this, but there's a big controversy going on right now. I was kind of looking into it a little bit on the internet last night, too, about the use of shunning in the Mormon church. There's a long history of that, where, you know, if you violate certain rules, and that certainly would involve if a person is gay, they are shunned from the community, pushed out. But also in some of those communities, not only is the gay person pushed out, or the violating person in some other way, who's been bad, but the entire family is pushed out and shunned. Unless the family totally rejects the member who's done the bad thing, then the family's welcome back in. This is a horrendously powerful tool. Of course, the Mormons aren't the only people who use it by any means. Related to shunning is ostracizing. It's that pushing out experience. And, of course, stigmatization, which is kind of the branding experience. And, you know, maybe the ultimate metaphor for that is the Scarlet Letter. Hester Prynne, I think, in the witch trials, had to wear to, like, permanently identify herself and to be exposed sort of indefinitely for presumably, in her case, being a witch. So the shamed person really becomes the other or the outsider. And that means that anybody who's different than the dominant group in any significant way is going to be more vulnerable to experiences of shame and having that inflicted upon them. And this, of course, includes all sexual minorities. Anyone who is sexually different is going to be more vulnerable to shame. And so I think those of us who are gay are more vulnerable to shame, generally speaking, than others may be. I'll say, and maybe fill this in a little bit more, that sexual shame seems to be, in our culture, where we don't generally put people up for public ridicule, although we have our ways of doing that, definitely, in the media, but most people don't really get exposed to that, shame really, as it presents in my work, is the sexual form of shame. Sexual shame is the most common manifestation that I see. So I want to go over just a little bit some of the damage that is caused by shame. Shame is such a powerful thing in its effects that it can easily really get out of control. And sometimes it's hard to have a little bit of shame because the effects can be so profound. And I've noticed that even one experience of shame, and most of us will have much more than one, but it can stay with us in our memory banks, like etched in there, for a lifetime. You know, usually when I present like this, I would bring in the experiences of clients that I've worked with, because of so much of what I know about anything, really, I've learned from my clients. But when it comes to shame, I was realizing, and I realized this before, I'm very limited in my ability and willingness to do this, because clients who are grappling with shame, like the rest of us, are so concerned about exposure that it's almost impossible to conceal. Like when I present a case, it's never really just one person. One of the ways I protect people is it's a composite made up of many people, and I change all the identifying details. But it doesn't matter. And I found this out in various ways, that people will see themselves in it and feel violated and exposed. In fact, I've had this happen when people have read particularly my Erotic Mind book, and they were quite sure I was talking about them, even when I wasn't. So anyway, I decided, and I will briefly mention some client experiences along the way today, but I thought I would take a risk, since I'm not going to talk much about my clients, and tell you about an experience of shame that I had that I've never told anybody before. In order to tell this story, you need to know a little bit about my background. I grew up in a very waspish middle-class neighborhood, actually in the city of Detroit, which was a much different place then than it is now. The neighborhood was really kind of idyllic, you know. It was like people knew each other. There was no crime. We left our doors open. We all walked to school. Nobody had to protect us. I don't remember a single abduction or, you know, anything like that. I grew up in a, I feel very lucky, in a very good family, but not without its problems, of course. But one of the values in my family that was talked about quite openly is that it was wrong to be prejudiced toward other people who were different, and racially especially. And I absorbed this, and I'm glad that I did. But, you know, and one thing that I didn't really think about at the time is that, you know, it's kind of easy to take that position when you're not exposed to anybody different. Our neighborhood was the most homogeneous neighborhood you've ever seen in your life. You know, it's like there was no, you know, it was all completely white. And so it was easy, in a way, to adopt this no prejudice position. So there was an incident that happened at some kind of a public pool not far from where I lived. I never knew clearly what the incident exactly was. All I knew, the story that I had heard, is that there was some kind of conflict or something that happened that involved some black kids and the majority white kids at this pool. Some conflict or something had taken place, and as a result, they had, for a time, closed down the pool. And that's all I really knew. I might have known a little more at the time. That's all I recall. But the experience I want to tell you about that has stuck with me is I knew no black kids in school at all. In fact, there weren't any until I went to junior high and high school, which for me was together. And there were a few black kids who I knew in passing but did not know well. But there was this instance where I found myself, I have no idea why, but I was in a car. I was in the front seat passenger. There was a teacher-type person driving, and in the black seat, in the back seat was a black kid. In the back seat was a black kid who I knew of but did not really know. Personally, I just kind of knew him in passing. I do remember, the only thing I remember about him is that in my mind, he's kind of cute. And the other thing is that I liked him. I guess it's understandable, this teacher figure, who I have no idea where it was or who it was or where we were going, but he said, "What's going on over there with the pool?" And I blurted out, "Oh, they've been having trouble with colored people." Dead silence. Nobody said another word about it. And I felt myself sinking, wanting to get out of the car, feeling just horrible. Part of it was I was empathizing on how that kid might feel. I didn't really mean to make him feel that way. As I thought about it, I was violating this principle in my family. Don't be prejudiced, you know? You kind of need to know that I've had in my life kind of somewhat of an inner conflict, because I was naturally and kind of raised to be a good boy. I didn't cause any trouble. I was cooperative. I was nice. I did well, all that kind of stuff. And yet, since as long as I can remember, it's been part of my either gift or curse in life, depending on how you look at it, to see and attempt to articulate the unspoken truths anywhere I am. I can't help it. And so, although I don't have to blurt out, right? But I did blurt out there, and I realized later that... and this helped somewhat to know that it wasn't just a personal faux pas on my part that I said that. I was articulating an unspoken attitude in the community. I felt shame for having done so. That's a very complicated experience. But I'm not racked with shame as a result of it, but I'll tell you, whenever I think about shame or things I regret that I've done, this comes to my mind first. And it's never left me. I don't think it ever will. So you can see the power of shame. This was, as shame goes, relatively minor infraction. You kind of get a picture of how this works. And so it's not much of a leap to think, and I'm sure many of you know about this, that huge, big problems, much bigger than I'm describing with my little shame experience, can happen to people on the individual level when especially a profound shame experience or a series of them takes root within a person and begins to shape and distort their development as a person in the world. And out of that shame, particularly if it starts early, can form fundamental core beliefs about who we are, our place in the world, our worth, our value, our lovability. These core beliefs are so deep. In cognitive psychology, they're referred to as schemas. Not that that matters what you call them, but generally speaking, the schemas or our deepest core beliefs operate outside of conscious awareness. What we see, or what we can see of our core beliefs, if they're shaped by shame, is the ways in which they manifest in day-to-day experience. So we might be aware, for example, and hopefully that we are aware, of what we say to ourselves in our heads, moment to moment in day-to-day experience, and ways in which we put ourselves down or demean ourselves, or the way we interpret events or misinterpret events around us as reflections of ourselves in terms of our inadequacies and our shortcomings. So there's that tendency to put a negative spin on things, so that when this happens, when a core belief within us has been shaped by shame, we're not talking about an emotion anymore, nor not just an emotion. We are talking about a state of being that then affects us as we move through life. It orients us to have and repeat certain kinds of experiences and to respond in a certain way. Now that's kind of an overview of the damage that shame can cause on an individual level. On a cultural level, shame, which is a tool the cultures use to get people to conform, it can get way out of control, horribly distorted, and be used for absolutely evil, horrendous ends. You know, maybe you've heard this too. I happen to be a fan of National Public Radio, but it's not the only place this is being talked about. But there's a lot of attention going on in the world now, which is a very good thing, the treatment of women in certain cultures and in general around the world. But it seems to be particularly bad in certain Middle Eastern and African countries. And so there's been a lot of coverage about this. And for example, one of the things that's being talked about a lot, since especially in Western Africa, there's a lot of civil wars and going on and stuff like that, there's a lot of discussion about how in that context, rape has become a weapon of war and is extremely widespread. And I think what makes it such an effective weapon is that not only is the woman shamed by being raped, but the her partner, if she has one, is shamed because he was helpless to protect her. The family was shamed, and so it demeans the whole community and weakens them. It's a very effective weapon of war. But this doesn't occur in a vacuum, because I've also been hearing lots of reports and reading things too about how, apart from the war aspect, in many of these countries, there's this idea, which is not completely gone in this country either, it has remnants, but the idea that if a woman is raped, it's her fault, and that she bears the brunt of the shame. Particularly in some of these central Western African and other African countries and Middle Eastern countries, Turkey even, which is a fairly advanced Muslim country, that a woman who is raped will be shunned by her own family for having shamed the family. So basically they go after the victim, push her out of the family. In some of these communities, it is not unusual and somewhat expected in certain cases that that woman will end up killing herself to spare the family the shame and herself. It's the only way out. I heard of a story, and this is not rare apparently, that it's a common practice in many places where a man will rape a woman, and then basically approach the family and ask for her hand in marriage. And the family basically has to say yes, because it's the only way to get out from under the shame that the daughter has caused. by getting raped. And so many women are forced by the family to marry the guy who raped her. And this is a tool where men can actually marry up, right, by raping at a higher level or a family or whatever, and end up marrying someone that otherwise they wouldn't be able to marry. I want to tell you this stuff partly because it's really on my mind, because it's in the news, but also it's really been striking me the unbelievable social power and consequences of shame, where it can absolutely override what you would think is the most, the strongest human emotion that it's possible to feel, or enduring, I would say, which is the bond between parent and child, if one forms. Shame will shatter it. That is how powerful it can be. So I want to just mention some of the things that can make us, or anyone for that matter, more vulnerable to shame than others. And there is quite a variation on that. Shame sometimes begins with our earliest pre-verbal experience, and that is the way we are touched and handled as infants. Body shame. And it's very hard to get at this, because we don't have any words for it. But many people that I've worked with in their investigations of their own shame came to understand that they held within their bodies an unspeakable shame about their physicality, and that they were dirty. It's hard to say how this works. It's not normal kind of memory at that age. Some people, who can say if it's a metaphor or what, but can recall in some way the experience of being touched as children and feeling very uncomfortable, like it was a reluctant kind of touch. And of course, I think the reason some people can remember that is you don't just, if there's that level of body discomfort in the family, it doesn't just happen during infancy, it continues to be manifest along the way. Then there's like, what is the proportion in a family situation of shaming behavior, which is kind of a rejecting, putting down, withdrawal of love, you're no good kind of thing as a way to control behavior in the family, versus nurturing, loving, affirming behavior. Now, the thing here is that it seems that shaming experiences carry more weight than nurturing ones. So if a person has a few badly shaming experiences in the family, but a lot of nurturing ones as well, they will remember the shaming ones more. They will have more of an impact. So I want to give you an example of that. This does reflect a client situation, but it's one that I've heard in so many forms from so many people. The client I've been working with, he remembers as clearly as my, you know, colored people experience with great intensity. Being a kid, maybe five, he's upstairs playing and kind of exploring, issues of gender and self-expression, really key stuff, which is the work of childhood, you know. So he finds this sort of shawl-type thing, and he's moving around and dancing to himself and enjoying the movement of the cloth, and gets kind of worked up and excited about it and goes running downstairs to share this with his family. But instead of greeting him with laughter, not derisive laughter, but fun, sharing it with him, his delight, they became angry at him and said, "Get back up to your room. Take that thing off. Put your pajamas on and go to bed." So that was that for self-expression of that type. This left a tremendous wound. And actually, this came to shape this man's erotic life. Because one of the reasons he came to see me is the realization that he has been attracted to super masculine men who would never do anything like that, and who would never face the shame and ridicule that he felt. And if he could get a man like that to want to be with him, this could help heal that shame. The only thing is, the minute that manly guy, and they got close enough and he started to see that guy's vulnerabilities, because no human being doesn't have their vulnerabilities, his attraction would fall through the floor, because they too were susceptible to ridicule. In fact, a lot of super masculine guys, their masculinity is fragile. It doesn't take much to undermine it. It's like propped up, kind of thing. And he really needed to explore all of this. And his relational problems was the catalyst to bring him in. But it became an exploration to a great extent of gender and shame. And being sort of gender nonconformist, you might say, is right up there with being sexually different in terms of being vulnerable to shame. Oh my gosh, time is rushing by. Since time is rushing by, I want to move now to the important part, and that is about healing shame. What the heck do we do with this? Basically, I could summarize by saying shame tends to disrupt the emergence of the true self in us. And I use this in the Jungian term. Carl Jung, the psychologist, had this concept of the self, which he thought was one of the most important of all human archetypes that shows up everywhere in human expression. The self, capital S. It is, you might say, the psychic equivalent of the genetic code. It is a built-in seed of who we are to become. That self contains everything that we might be. And really the goal of development and actualization in life is to have the self, inner self, emerge, to become whole, to become manifest in the world. I'm sure you'll be interested in this, in the Jungian idea of the self, this growing manifestation of the self includes the eventual realization that we are not individual selves, but we are connected with all the others as well. So the self enlarges to the point where it joins with all of humanity, or even beyond the universe, if you will. So this is included in the concept of the self. Luckily, the self tends to be highly resistant and resilient to the debilitating effects of shame. And given halfway of a nurturing, supportive environment in most of us, under the right conditions, the self, no matter how much it has been damaged, will seek to reassert itself. So it's a matter of like finding an opening and becoming our own self-nurturing beings. And this takes a lot of courage to do. On a very practical level, when we're dealing with a specific shame that we hold, let's say one about sexuality, that we have an unconventional turn on, a fetish, or some socially disapproved thing that really excites us, or we're out of control in our sexuality, whatever. When we have that kind of shame in sex or elsewhere, since the shame experience is to hide, disclosure is a natural antidote to shame. It's difficult, though. because I always do put on the table for people who come to me maybe because they read The Erotic Mind and realize I'm not inclined to be judgmental about unusual turn-ons, so they feel they can talk to me about it. And then when we get into the shame part, I will encourage them usually or raise the subject. Is there anyone that you tend to confide in mutually in your life who's supportive and cares about you that you could consider disclosing this to? Oh, I can never do that. You know, I'll never push anyone to do that because you really never know how people are going to react. But it's not like the disclosure of shame is not done lightly. You have to sort of pick very carefully a person based on experience or intuition of someone who will hear what you have to say and be interested and not put you down for it. Now, pride is a good antidote for shame, as in gay pride, but it's not enough. We can't just stop there with pride. Because the ultimate antidote to shame, it seems to me, is compassion, which is to, instead of desperate attempts to fight off shame, to turn away from it, to reject it, to turn toward it, to see the shame that exists within ourselves, to recognize that it's there, to become mindful of how it operates day to day, and ultimately to embrace it as a part of our experience. And doing so begins to call forth the true self. What we need to do this, what compassion allows us to do, might be called radical self-acceptance, which means accepting who we are at all levels, including the most unacceptable, shameful parts of ourselves. They must be accepted, or the healing cannot occur. Now, in too many instances, way, way, way too many, people's religious convictions and practices have actually promoted shame. Because there's a standards that we can fail at. Sins can translate into shame. But at the same time, as I'm sure you know, certain spiritual experiences that remind us of our connections beyond ourselves or take us to our deep self, which is another road to that connection, that these experiences, these spiritual experiences, can reconnect us with who we are and help us to continue to unfold. The Jungian concept of the self is really very much like the Buddha within idea, or the higher self, if you will. Basically, as we apply compassion to our shaming experiences and we accept ourselves, we start to reposition ourselves in the world. And instead of adopting an inferior position or expecting to be demeaned or feeling like we'll never be loved, or that especially as we become known and seen, we will be rejected, all of this becomes much more manageable. And we become available to present ourselves in daily life in ways that we have previously been reluctant to do. And I wanted to conclude by going back to the horrendous Africa rape story. I heard about a woman from a reporter, who did an extended story, who's been living and I forget which, but it was a Western African country, who had met and come to know a woman who had been raped, and the rapist had asked the family to marry her. She had been shunned from the family prior to that. But this woman, illiterate African woman, not only refused to marry this guy, she pressed charges, which of course is a pretty futile enterprise, since the men generally do this with impunity, but she basically, technically, there were laws, you know, and she called them forth. And then she did something else, many other things. She became literate, she became a lawyer, and she started an organization that exists now to support women in these situations. And they have a whole network of women and centers in that African country where a woman who faces a situation like this, who has been raped and is being shamed or asked to marry the guy, can come to this group, be taken in and protected by them, and they will nurture her and protect her and fight for her to help her restore herself. This makes me cry. I'm inspired by this, and I was so glad to hear about it. Now, I don't know how many of us could go through what she went through and come out like that. I don't know what makes that possible, but it is possible, and people do some version of that every day. And I guess what it tells us is that in the face of shame and all the other difficulties that we face, we really should never underestimate the power of the self, no matter how damaged it may have been. So I want to stop there and ask if you want to make a comment or a question or something. Yes, sir.
Something I would like you to speak to, if you can. From my own personal experience, I know that the development of consciousness of shameful events and addressing them, accepting them through disclosure or whatever is really the only way to
It's the starting point. You can't do anything without it.
But it's always... It's sometimes it's such an incredibly long journey from the intellectual awareness of that occurrence to the point at which it becomes sufficiently experiential so that you can actually...
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can speak to how...
Well, and the other thing, I mean, I think this is related to what you're saying, is that the development of consciousness of our shame and what it means and what happened, you know, is essential. We can't do anything about anything without being aware of it. But then that means facing it, and that means feeling its full impact. And so it can be kind of a shattering experience, especially if there's a tremendous amount of shame, if we've been deeply shamed, and it's kind of become a central part of who we are, that in seeing that in its full glory, we must be prepared to have a tremendous range of emotions over time. It's a process. It's not a steady ladder. Especially for those who are inclined to depression, sometimes exploring this territory will threaten to throw them over the edge into a depressed state. And that's always a danger. And so it has to be done delicately and sensitively, and people have to learn to be kind and patient with themselves. And if we can do it in interaction with someone who is kind and patient with us, it's going to be a lot easier. Yes, sir.
Well, I have two areas of question. One is about early on about the difference between guilt and shame, which I see as more different, but the other one is perhaps more important. As I heard it, you were presenting shame as a bad thing. And yeah, certainly don't disagree with that, and oftentimes. But what came to mind is some of the examples I've seen from Asian cultures in which when political leaders or business leaders are exposed publicly for not typically sexual, but fiduciary malfeasance, they resign, they quit, they sometimes commit suicide. Whereas in the United States, when that happens, they,
they get a bonus. Yeah, well, yeah, I did allude to, but not much more than allude to, correct, to how shame is a social process, and that it is essential, but it has these pitfalls. But yes, and that's why I said the goal is not to be shameless or not ever have shame, because that would be, that's just a sociopathic thing if we never. So yes, there's lots of situations where we violate our own and our communities and our families' norms that are good norms, and that we feel bad about it, and it provides a self-corrective impetus. This is a good thing. What I was emphasizing is how shame can fly out of control, both individually and culturally, and wreak this havoc. But yes, if it's kept within bounds, shame is an important emotion in terms of it, it's sort of a self-correcting thing. And, you know, I think that, you know, the great psychologist Abraham Maslow talked about peak experiences and actualization. He would say, he talked about existential guilt, or you could say existential shame, which is what we experience when we basically are not true to our true selves. It's healthy to feel guilty about that when we know we've fallen short of what we could be. And but, I mean, they're also, that's why we have forgiveness. And that's why we have some kind of a way of coming back into our own good graces and the good graces of the community. You know, but lots of times when the shame gets out of control, that's not what happens. It's not self-corrective. It actually becomes self-inhibitory and prevents us then from becoming who we can be. But yes, shame is not just a bad thing.
And it's about the struggle to determine what are appropriate social norms.
That's
for
right.
For example, the one about being gay has substantially changed.
Yeah.
The current prominent struggle, I think, is about being fat.
That would be one of them. And absolutely. And there's many more. But yes, those evolve, and all cultures have, you know, some presumably sensible norms and some really, really stupid ones. And it seems to be always a mix like that.
Dr. Warren, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I hope maybe you can hang around after the close.
Oh, sure.
Answer questions during our social hour.
Be glad to.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Glad to talk to you. Do we have announcements?
My name is Cass. I'm your host today, so please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha. We'll have refreshments and tea, and if you have some tea, please wash your cup with hot soapy water. There's a sign-up list on the counter over by the wall to get on the email list. There's a donable right beside the sign-up sheet. So there's an opportunity to practice generosity and help the Sangha meet its expenses. I guess $5 to $8 is suggested, but whatever you choose to donate would be gratefully accepted. Some people go out to lunch around 12:30. They gather at the front door. And that's all I have.
Tonight, the second of two concerts, San Francisco Choral Society, Stringbox, Magnificat, and the last three oratorios of the Christmas oratorio. And we did it last night, and it was gorgeous. Bill Childs and I are in the section, and it's like a bright, starlit night type of music. Also, I saw posters around next Friday at the Palace of Legion, no, a Palace of, the one in the ruin, whatever palace that is, is that the Whirling Dervishes are coming as in honor of Rumi's 900th birthday, I think. And if you've never seen this, it is indescribably sublime. I highly recommend it.
George.
Yes, a reminder that our talks are available on the internet at the GBF website, gaybuddhist.org.
And if anybody is interested in continuing their sitting practice, a good 1-2 punch on Monday afternoon between 5:30 and 6:30, there's a sitting group at the Gay Center here in San Francisco. It's a very sweet group. It's a mixed group. And it's a half-hour meditation at 5:36, and then a half-hour talk and short discussion every Monday at 5:30 at the Gay Center.
Hi, I'm Jack. GBF publishes a newsletter, which is available online, but we also send out hard copies. This time, just under 350. More than half of those are prisoners. And so today, we're a little week tardy, but we have a bunch to fold and staple and label and stamp and collate. I think we don't have to collate. But if I can get about 12 volunteers or so, about a dozen, I'd like to see a show of hands for commitment, please. That'd be a big help. And we'll do that about 15 minutes after the social hour starts. Thanks.
Howard?
Yeah, Jack, wow, thank you very much for your presentation. And you're in our loops. I knew you were talk would be inspired today when I saw that your socks and shirts.
I had to reveal the whole thing. I wasn't counting on that.
But thank you for your gift, and we look forward to your return sometime next year. And I'm a member of the program committee. We have other program committee members here. Jim Stewart, where's Jerry, if you would raise your hand. Who else is here? We are responsible for bringing to the Sangha our speakers in this community, and I just received from Harley Shapiro a whole list of 8 new Dharma teachers from all different traditions, Tibetan, Vietnam, Vipassana, all different traditions, and looking forward to scheduling them in 2010. So you are our primary source for the speakers, and so we'd really like you to approach us with names, teachers that have come across your path, if you found a really resource, of course, hopefully gay-friendly, and certainly out gay men and women as Dharma teachers, we certainly like to emphasize and present. So talk to us. We're also continuing to expand the membership on the program committee. It's a wonderful experience, and if you're interested in making kind of a joyful and celebrative contribution of service to the Sangha, and think this may be an area that inspires you, talk to all of us also. And so our speaker next week will be Arena Weissman, and a prominent Dharma teacher here in the Bay Area. We look forward to her time with us next week. Thank you again, Jeff.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Michael Langan, our editor of the newsletter, for his years of service. And Gary Ost transcribed the talk for the article this time, so thank you very much.
Our fellow Sangha member, Donald Dean, is back in the hospital. You may recall he's had severe heart problems. This time it's not as serious. He's in with an infection, and his lungs are about half filled up with fluid, so he should be able to take care of it and get out this week, but if you could keep him in your thoughts, that would be great.
Other announcements? Well, let's gather in a circle for a call. Why don't we do 2 circles, one inside and one outside?
As we look around our room at our fellow Sangha members,
May we all be safe from danger and harm, both internal and external. May we all become conscious and aware of any shame in our lives and find the tools and the compassion and the expression to overcome it. And may the benefit of our practice be a benefit to all beings everywhere.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.